From Hong Kong, this is the Mea Culpa podcast, with lessons learned from startups. Based on the Postmortem conference, where founders, investors, lawyers and mentors share their stories about working on, with or for startups. Today, we have Melissa Kwan. Melissa Kwan is the founder and CEO of eWebinar, an automated webinar platform for video and other tutorials. Melissa, you can better explain. Go ahead and give a 1 minute elevator pitch on what you do.
Awesome. Thanks for the quick intro. My name is Melissa Kwan. I'm the co-founder and CEO of eWebinar right now. It's my third bootstrap startup. I've been in startups for 12 years. eWebinar saves people from doing the same repetitive webinar over and over again for things like sales demos, sales pitches, onboarding, training, things that you might be doing on Zoom once a month. We would take a video and turn it into a webinar so you can do hundreds of them without ever needing to be in front of a camera to actually do them live.
That's great. And you say this is your fifth bootstrapping startup?
Third.
What was your third? Sorry.
I don't think I have another one in me. So five would be like Olympic level.
Never say never. What was the first one?
The first one was a product turned agency. Like, we wanted to be a product, but then because we were bootstrapped and everybody, like, we needed the money. So we said yes to a lot of people. Before you knew it, we were building custom apps for individual companies. So the first one was an interactive brochure on the iPad for pre-built buildings, right? So like residential real estate, when they try to sell you a unit before it's actually built, you walk into a sales center, get a beautiful brochure for that. We were the iPad version.
Okay. Because that was your first entrepreneurial journey, but before that you had a corporate journey, right? I know you did a lot of business development in different areas, but what made you decide to become an entrepreneur?
I mean, I think I was always entrepreneurial, but I was never an entrepreneur. Like, I'm not from an entrepreneur family. My mom never worked. My dad was in the same company for 40 years. So all they wanted for me was a good, stable job or to marry rich. Like, there were like two paths, right? I think people listening might be able to relate to this. But I always wanted to try things on the side. I think growing up, I was always very envious of my friends who were from entrepreneur families, and they would try things with their parents, right? And I was always very curious about that. But I just didn't really have the know-how. And my last job that I left was at SAP, where I sold large enterprise software as part of the inside sales team in Vancouver, Canada. And I just remember hating working in a big company. Like, I just didn't fit in that mold. Previously to SAP, I was working for small, medium-sized companies where I was still allowed to be my own person. So I didn't really realize that that's what I needed in my life to be happy. I only lasted at SAP for about a year. And I wanted to leave so badly. And at the time I was like in my mid-20s and I just felt like it was time. Like, there wasn't really like a trigger or anything. I was so sick of waking up early. I'm not a morning person. And going to work and listening to other people tell me what to do. So I just walked out of that company and started my first company. And I mean, it was a very rough journey. Like, I think I tried like maybe 10 ideas before one of them actually worked out, like before the first person, you know, decided to pay us some money for what we built. And it just kind of started from there. And that was about 12 years ago.
And how do you prepare yourself for that? Because just quitting your job, right? You probably at that point have a salary, you have costs, you might have a mortgage or maybe a lease on an apartment. You might have a car, all those payments, all those kind of things. Like, how do you prepare yourself for that? Did you like save up money? Did you get some investors? Did you borrow money? Like, how did you make yourself ready for that jump?
I mean, I think that's a great question. I prepared for it by not thinking I needed to prepare for it. right? Because I was so young and I didn't have, I'm just not from that background. So, and I think there's like a point where experience hinders you, right? You're like, I've been through this, or I've seen other people do this, or I've seen my parents do this, and it's very scary. So I'm going to take my time to take that leap. But I didn't have all that background information. So at the time, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to start a company. And then in 6 months, someone's going to pay me for something. Like, I actually thought that. I mean, now it seems very naive, but I do think that when you're young, you can take those risks, right? I didn't have a mortgage, luckily. I don't think I'd be able to do it with a mortgage. But, you know, I was living in Vancouver at the time. It was pretty affordable, right? It's nothing like Hong Kong. Like, at the time, like, my rent was something like $1,200, like Canadian. So it wasn't a huge chunk of money. Like, nowadays, it would probably be like double that at least. But I always had commission jobs because I was always in sales and business development. So as a, you know, 26, 27 year old, I probably had something like, I want to say like $75,000 or $80,000 in my bank, right? And at the time, that was a lot of money, or you think that's a lot of money. So I quit thinking, well, you know, I've got all this money. It's going to last me 2 years, right? And I'm going to, you know, I'm going to find something that, you know, people are going to pay for. And it's going to be great. So that money probably lasted me less than 9 months because I was trying things, right? I was hiring contractors, hiring designers, like, and I just really underestimated how long it would take to actually get a product out to market. And then from then on, we had like government grants, right? Canada has a lot of government grants because they're trying to create jobs. I borrowed money from my parents multiple times to the point where they stopped talking to me for 2 years because they're like, you're not taking your life seriously. And we never got any investment because I couldn't find something that was worth investing in. And that went on for probably 2 years before I found that first product that was like the iPad brochure. Because we were down on money so much that I'm like, okay, here are the 10 things that I tried. What is the one thing that I can turn into something related to real estate? Because previous to SAP, I was in the real estate industry, that I could just sell to contacts that I know. And there was one of the things that we tried that was like an iPad magazine. And we basically took the shell of that app, put in property information, and then I just set up a meeting with a property developer and said, look at this thing. It's called an iPad. Like, back then, like, it had just come out. And it could make your paper brochure into this digital downloadable brochure. And that was actually the first sale.
Okay. And you said a few times we. Like, who was we in that journey?
So I had a co-founder back then that started as a contractor. So, and I actually believe that jumping, like, a lot of people jump into co-founder relationships because they think they need one. But I've had two co-founders in my life and they've both started as contractors. Like, I'd worked with him for probably over a year, like, paid him as a contractor, which is actually where most of the money went, right? It didn't actually go to my living expense. It went to paying someone else. And it wasn't until we found that product that people would pay for, me realizing that it's actually pretty hard, not impossible, but pretty hard to have a tech company without a tech co-founder, that I pitched him the idea that he should stop taking other client work and we should do this together full time.
Okay. All right. And I guess that was a positive reaction from him. How did you raise it? Because you were already working on that for an hour. You took all the risk and you paid him. Can you tell us a little bit about the ins and outs of that decision? And was it at that point a 50-50 deal or a 95-5%? Or what? How did that discussion go and where did it end up?
You know, that is such a good question. And no one's ever asked me that before. In hindsight, I should have done it differently. Again, because I was so inexperienced. And having this experience in the first time did allow me to do it differently the second time. But I thought back then that the CTO was the most important person in a tech company, because developers are hard. Like, great developers are hard. The really good ones are working for really big companies and getting paid a lot, or they're picking and choosing their co-founder, or they're doing something themselves, right? And he was a great developer. In hindsight, he wasn't a great CTO, and that actually caused a lot of friction down the road. But what I didn't know and what I didn't realize was, while the CTO builds the product, the CEO, me, builds the entire business. Had I known that when we were having those discussions early on, I would have had, you know, a more equitable share, share split, knowing that fact. So our split was 60-40. But in hindsight, I think it should have been like more like 70-30, or, you know, maybe even 75-25, right? But, you know, we worked together for 9 years. You know, we worked on the first two startups together. He was like a great partner. He was my best friend, and it was okay. But over the years, like, to your point, he never put in a financial investment. I didn't pay myself for at least the first 3 years. I was in hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of debt. I was the person that borrowed all the money from my parents, from the bank, under my name. While he never got a market salary for a long time, he still never had to take any financial risk. So that was one of my bigger regrets, especially when the second company we built together was acquired. Ultimately, like, I feel like the effort put in for the return was not fully equitable, but it kind of is what it is.
That's, of course, a great learning. That's a great hindsight idea. But when you started and you said, like, okay, let's become co-founder, you had some things arranged, like a co-founder agreement, or was it just the shareholders agreement, and there everything was arranged? Or how did you split up the work and the responsibilities on paper?
Yeah, I mean, it's a shareholders agreement, vested for 4 years. It's super standard. Like, I'm a believer of standard documents, because that also, like, not only does that keep things super simple for you, right? It makes it really easy for someone to buy your company. So everything that I do in the past, now, in the future will be very vanilla. That's actually my requirement. And as far as, like, splitting up the work, I mean, we were a bootstrap company. Everybody does everything. Right. And what makes someone really good at a startup versus, you know, a big corporate situation is the fact that they can do everything. Right. So for a long time, it was actually just the two of us. Like, he was everything product. Right. Like, he was a, you know, a full stack coder. He was designer, like, you know, just graphics designer, website, plus the product designer. We needed photos, so, and he knew how to take photos. So he was also like a photographer, right? So, and then I was everything except for that, right? Like, you know, recruiting, product management, like accounting, admin, sales, customer success. So we basically just filled in the gaps, right, for each other. And then as we started making more and more money, the only team we had to expand was development. So for those companies, I continued to do everything outside of product. And then as we hired more developers, more and more stuff would, like, come off his plate.
That first venture that you did together, where did it end it, and how did it end it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think, and I had mentioned earlier that was a product turned agency. So mm-hmm. I actually didn't even realize we were an agency until a friend told me that I was an agency. I'm like, what do you mean? Like, I build products. But he's like, no, you build one-off apps for different people. You are an agency. And I'm like, oh my God, like, you're right. This is why it feels so hard, right? Because we wanted to charge people monthly, but then they wouldn't pay us, right? Because we already gave them the product and we found things that we wanted to service, but they didn't actually need the service until they wanted an app upgrade. Like, when maybe, like, the new OS came out, and then we would charge them a little bit to, like, resubmit it to the app store, but it wasn't a SaaS business. So anyone that's run a business, an agency business before, knows that, like, you build an app and you give it to the client and then you're chasing the invoice, but then they don't want to pay you because they already have the app. Or they'll try to delay that, right? And then you can't cut them off because then they won't give you their next project. So I was in this like constant hamster wheel of looking for a new client, trying to get the invoice. And I was doing that for so long and constantly prospecting. I was just kind of exhausted from that. And back then, like, I mean, LinkedIn wasn't what it is now, but I was scrounging LinkedIn for leads in Canada and the US so much that one day it thought I was a bot. That's how much I had to go and prospect. And so I remember making my last cold call or cold email, and I'm like, I'm just not doing this again, right? Like there's no future to this. So we have to go and build a product that we offer everybody. And so my first company bridged into my second company. So my second one was also in real estate tech. It was an open house check-in solution. So when you walk into a residential property that's being sold through an open house, previous to us, you would write down your name and email on a piece of paper. We were the iPad check-in version, and we sold that product to companies, right? Brokerages, franchises, so that they can offer their sales agents like as a perk, right, for working with our company. So the first company didn't really shut down. I just stopped selling, right? Like, and when somebody came to me, I would mark up the price so much that they wouldn't buy. And then eventually that just kind of fizzled out. But in order to fund the second company, I basically took a loan, a personal loan, against the revenue that we had, and then took all the money out and put it into a second company. And that's actually why I was in hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of debt, because I had did that move in order to fund the second company, thinking that, oh yeah, I would just build a product and people would buy it. Again, like I had that mindset. But turns out building a SaaS company is much harder than building an agency. And that's kind of like, and that was actually when I entered what I would now consider the lowest point of my career and the toughest point of my entrepreneur journey.
Legally, you can of course take out the loan from one company and put it in the other one, right? Like, what did that do to you, or did you not realize it at that point? Like, that's a huge step to do.
Yeah, I was also very naive because I had never started a product company before. So I didn't realize how difficult it would be to come up with a product that people would put in their credit card for and pay you every month. But the thing is, because of my first company, I was going to New York because that's where like all the property developers were, and that's where all the real estate tech companies were. I was going to New York regularly to try to find more customers, and eventually I moved there to just be around people like myself who are building startups, but also to be around the industry. There wasn't any, you know, restrictions against borrowing money and then putting in a new company. Like, the bank just wanted you to pay them every month. And so I just underestimated how long it would take. Like, it took us about, so the second company I ran for 5 years in total, but it took me 2.5 years before getting our first $10. And those 2.5 years was where all the investment like got sunken into, right? We had an idea. It was going to be an open house app. But it started as a massive solution with hardware, software, consumer, like business. Like, it was so complicated. And then we just kept trying to change it, like, so that, like, to adapt to something. And we would always have beta customers, and they would just give us, like, you know, they would give us, I guess, false validation, because they're like, oh yeah, this is great, we'll try it. But then they never actually try it. So we kept thinking that we were onto something when we weren't. And I remember being in New York, one of the most expensive cities in the world, like comparable to Hong Kong, and like having one meal a day and timing it so I wouldn't get hungry at night. For probably a year and a half, I had less than $100 in my account in a day. And depending on what I had to spend, I would take a little bit out of the company. I would pay everyone else, see what's left, and then pay myself at the end of the month just to cover rent on the first. But I was like constantly juggling, right? And I would take side projects to cover the next payroll. And this, it just happened for a really long time. right? And that was kind of what happened. It was just underestimating like how difficult it is to find a SaaS product that people actually cared about.
What was the moment? Was there an aha moment when you were building the product that you said like, oh, this is it, and that was indeed it, or wasn't there, and it just at one point you started realizing that some of the items inside of the product that you were developing were the golden eggs?
Yeah, so I remember I was so exhausted from trying so many things that didn't work, but I didn't have a way to get out. Like I was so deep into this thing, right? Like, and my co-founder at the time had already been working with me for 6 years. Like, and I felt responsible, right? Because he could have gone to work for Amazon or Facebook or some cool startup. But I sold him this vision. And then at the time, we had also a small team that, you know, I had also sold my vision to. So, and then my I didn't want to give it up because I didn't have anywhere else to go. Like, how else was I going to pay back all this debt? And what was I going to tell my parents that, you know, were already so angry that I didn't have a real job for so many years? And I remember we had 3 more months of runway. And that was it. And of course, my co-founder was also exhausted because as the creator of a product, as the artist of this product, when nobody uses it, like it's kind of defeating, right? And so I remember having 90 more days. And I remember a friend telling me once, if you have 90 days left, you better do something significantly different because what you're doing is not working. So I made a decision to give it one last go. And I was going to try it for 90 days. And I promised myself that I would leave no stone unturned. Anybody that might give me money, I would talk to them, right? Like I would try to raise it from family and friends or from a VC. Any customer that is a potential, I would go and talk to them. And so it was during that time that I talked to a VC in the shared space that I was working out of that said, okay, well, it looks like you're onto something. Like it sounds like you're onto something, but your product is too big, right? It's got all these moving parts. What you need to do is remove 90% of those features and focus on the one feature that everybody's going to use. What does everybody do at an open house? They check in. Like the agent requires the prospect to check in because that's how they make money. The follow-up is where they make money. So he's like, just make it a form, right? Remove all this stuff, remove the consumer part, make it a business product, just make it a check-in form. And then at the time, I'm like, why would anyone use that? It's so simple. It's like stupid. And he was like, yeah, but just try it because don't worry about the 1,000 customers. Get the first 10 customers using this. That's all that matters. And then you'll get 100. And then you can worry about getting 1,000. And so I walked into that VC meeting, I called my co-founder and I said, hey, this is the feedback that I got. I think it makes sense. I'm not sure people are going to use it, but we don't have a choice. Let's give it a try. And that's exactly what we did. So we took the massive product that we had. We cut out everything except for the check-in form. It wasn't even an iPad app. It was like a mobile responsive one-page website. That basically when you typed your name and email in, it went to like our database on the end. And then I just went to like Craigslist, which is like a, you know, a sell everything website, you know, in North America. And I emailed agents that were having open houses that weekend and said, hey, we're a new company. We're testing this thing. Would you try it? And then I got like 5 people to try it. And then I would like secret shopper those open houses on the weekend and see if they were actually using it. And when I walked in the home, I would see how they would invite me to sign in. And then I started to see people were actually using it. And that was actually the aha moment is I think we think about startups like we have to be so innovative, right? Like we have to be so bleeding edge. Otherwise, we're not making a difference. But it turns out innovation is changing the way someone does something forever It doesn't have to be. And a lot of times it's not a giant leap, right? Because people's imagination is not that big. It turns out innovation has to happen incrementally. And when we came up with a product that was digital paper, like it literally just replaced the piece of paper. It was digital paper in the open house. People started to understand how it worked. When the product was really cool, like all these people were excited to learn about it, but they weren't using it because it was like, it just had too many moving parts, right? There were too many things that you have to do in order to make it work. So that was the aha moment where we started making that sign up like our core product. And then we started over time adding back in some of the features as people were adopting the product.
Okay. It's always indeed good to have a product what 10 people love to use than 1,000 people like to use, right? I think it's Four Steps to Epiphany or something else like that from Steve Blank to get to the realization indeed what people need. Great story because and a great experience for you also, because at that point you really start to learn that a lot of features isn't going to save your company. It's usually the core of the business at that point what makes it very valuable. Also interesting to hear that you went secret shopping to see how they do it, because that's I also quite often say there's only one way to build a product for the users, is to know exactly what your users are doing and how they're using it, because at that point you really know how they're using it and what they're doing and what their thought process is. I sometimes say to founders, if I wake you up at 3 a.m. in the morning, you should know exactly what your customer at that point, on the other side of the world, of course, is doing, right? Where are they? Like, what kind of phone do they have? Is it an Android or is it an Apple phone? Or is it or are they using it on a tablet? Or are they using it on something else? Right? Something you really should know back and forward from your potential customer, especially in the beginning. Of course, their quantity goes over quality. Quality goes over quantity. That was it.
Absolutely.
Yes. Then you said that it took you 2.5 years to get there, and that was your drastic moment of doing something else, and you still had 90 days. What did you achieve in those 90 days after the I wouldn't say pivot, but like after cutting away all the excess? Like how was the journey going within those 90 days that you said basically after the 19 days, yes, this is now bringing in so much traction, we are going to continue?
Yeah, I mean, it continues to be hard, right? Because if a few people use your product, it doesn't mean you have product market fit. It just means a few people are using your product, right? Maybe some people like it and then some people don't. Like me, like, I think a lot of people think like, getting your first 100 customers is the hardest. Actually, I don't think that's true. I think getting customers beyond that is the hardest. You can always find a first group to use your product, but that's not going to sustain your business. That just means you might be onto something. So at that point, we had a product. Individual agents, individual real estate agents were using it. And then it only took a couple months because New York is such a real estate city, right? It's kind of like London and Hong Kong. Like everyone's always looking at real estate. We started getting inquiries from companies, from brokerages, right? Saying, do you have a company version of this that we can buy and offer everybody? And of course, as a bootstrap CEO, you always say yes when a company's like, do you have this? Yes. And then I was like, yeah, in fact, we are building it right now and we are doing customer interviews to see, how we can actually build this out to spec. And that was how I started getting these company interviews telling me what they would want in a company level open house product. And it was within those few months that we came up with a first version of an enterprise, of an enterprise product for the open house. And because my background is B2B sales, right? My background is enterprise sales. That's how I know how to sell. Once we had that product, it wasn't very hard for me to go to different companies and be like, hey, this is what we're selling. But it still took time, right, to stack up that revenue. But because it was an enterprise product, our contract values were anywhere from $5,000 US a year to $100,000 US a year, right? It would just depend on the size of the company. Fortunately, once we found our first $10, it took us only a year to break even on the team that we had. And then I started like paying myself a little more. So I had mentioned it. I had ran that company for 5 years. So 2.5 years to find our first $10, a year to break even. And then a year after, that company was acquired by a bigger company within that industry. So what people saw was the 1 year that we were live, right? And we were like selling to companies. What they did not see was the 8 years that I had invested in getting to that point, right? The first company allowed me to meet all these companies, getting to know, you know, the real estate startups, the startup scene, moving to New York, which actually bridged into my second one. And there was just a lot of pain in that, right? There was a lot of trial and error and things that didn't work. But ultimately, we did have a good outcome. And luckily, we pushed through that really difficult period, because during that period, it would have been really easy to give up. Like if I had given up during that time, nobody would look at me and say, oh, she didn't work hard enough or she didn't try enough things. Like I was trying so many things and working so hard that people were asking me to give up, right? Because it was just so ridiculous. So I'm glad that we pushed forward and came out the other end. But that's what happened. That was kind of the timeline. So it didn't take that long for us to build up that revenue enough for it to be meaningful for another company to acquire the company.
Okay. And how did you make the decision to being acquired? Because that's like, you've been working on this for many, many years. And all of a sudden somebody comes and say like, hey, we want to buy you. Like, and of course, if they come with $1 billion or $1 trillion, probably say yes. But I don't think it's $1 billion or $1 trillion exit. So like, how do you make that decision?
Yeah. So it was not a retirement level exit, right? It was a life-changing exit, right? And it was also life-changing because I never had money. So you go from like zero, right, to something. It's like amazing, right? It was a seven-figure exit. I made that decision because I've been working on it for so many years, right? I was just exhausted. Like, frankly, I just wanted a break. And I actually wanted to get out of the industry because it wasn't fun, right? And we built software, you know, for real estate agents. It's a really, really tough group to sell to. It's a really tough group to get to adopt anything. Like just traditionally, that industry is slow to adopt innovation, like period. And I think like real estate agents have a very short-lived career within real estate. Like it's one of the highest churn industries out there. So people are not churning from my product. They were churning from their jobs. And that makes it really difficult to make a product sticky. And what does that mean for a company selling enterprise to real estate agents is you're constantly needing to onboard and train new customers because they're coming and going. And actually, that's what gave me the idea for eWebinar, because I was doing all these onboarding and training webinars constantly to make sure that my companies would not cancel the plans, right? So I just wanted a change, like having spent almost a decade in that industry and just trying so hard. And at the time, there were so many cool things in the world. And this was like 2019, right? There were so many cool things happening in the world that I wasn't a part of. So not only did I feel like it's been a decade, I want to change, the opportunity cost for not doing something else was becoming higher and higher. Because if you look at the acquisitions of companies in real estate, it's like, 3 to 5 times on average, right? But if you look at SaaS outside, like pure SaaS, it's like 10, 20 times revenue. So meanwhile, I'm working so hard to try to get people who don't want to adopt technology to adopt it. Like, I could actually be working in another industry, spending the same effort and getting, you know, 3-4 times the exit, right? So I was just starting to do that math in my head, and I didn't really feel like my efforts were getting kind of appropriate ROI. So I wasn't shopping the company because at that time, we were already profitable, right? I didn't really want to work for someone else if I didn't have to. But I was at the time talking to an industry friend of mine and actually just complaining to him, right? And I was just saying, hey, it's been so long. I'm kind of tired. I want to do something else. And I wonder if my co-founder would let me sell my share. But I don't think he would. And at the time, he was like, you know what? Like, we're looking to make our first acquisition. If you're serious, maybe we can look into acquiring you guys, but you have to stay. Like, you have to stay for at least 2 years. And
golden handcuffed.
Yeah. And actually, that was what happened. We had that conversation like in November of 2018. And that deal closed 2 months later. Like, we rushed it because we wanted to announce something in the new year. But yeah, that was kind of the decision. I was like, I just wanted a life change. And it just so happened that someone I love and respect was like, yeah, like, we could potentially buy you if the numbers work out.
Do you think it's luck or fate?
I mean, I think you create your luck always and you create your fate, right? I think opportunities are always out there. And you have to be open to finding them and creating them and accepting them. So I think it's a bit of both.
Okay. And then what you're doing right now, you've already been doing this almost 4 years. That's a year short of what you did previously. How are you on track if you want to keep it in the same time zone? Like, what, where are you now with the current development? What is the next 1 to 2 year plan for this?
Yeah, so I started eWebinar 2 months after that company was acquired. And I basically, like I mentioned, it wasn't retirement level exit. So I knew I needed to start something else. But I don't want to work forever, right? I don't want to wait another 2 years. And there were two reasons why I started that company. One, I just needed another creative outlet. Like, I wanted to do something in a different industry so badly just to keep my brain moving. But I also saw how high consumer expectations were. And I didn't want to wait for them to be even higher in order to start a business, right? Like, I think it's getting easier and easier to build something, but it's harder and harder to get someone to put in their credit card. I mean, just think about me and you, right? How many things have to be in an app or a piece of software before you're like, yeah, I think I'm going to pay for this. So eWebinar was a problem that I lived with for 5 years when I was growing that previous startup. I was constantly doing these trainings on GoToWebinar and then Zoom. Like, whatever webinar software didn't suck, I would try to use that. But I mean, webinars are ultimately not scalable. So I was always dreaming up this product that would do my job for me while I could go and have fun or do something else, right? And all these webinars were the same. I'm like, why do I have to do it? Like, it could just be a video and then we could make it more engaging, have like a chat system where you could hop in to respond live or later through email, but it just runs a video. So I got my CEO at the time to sign off on me working on a side project that doesn't conflict with real estate. And he knew, because he was my friend, he knew that if he didn't let me do it, it would just be a really hard time for everybody. And but also as a fellow entrepreneur, like, you kind of have empathy for that stuff. And so it took us 2 years to build the product. And then we released it summer of 2020. So it's been, you know, 25 months, a little over 2 years since we've launched the product. It's also a bootstrap team. And I have not been able to pay myself yet. So it's, I'm like kind of back in that startup grind, but it's because I had the previous exit that allowed me to start this on my own terms, right? That allowed me to build a team that, you know, build a team that I want. We have no full-time employees. Everybody's a contractor, including my co-founder and now a different co-founder. And so we're inching now towards profitability, but we're not quite there.
Okay. And you already talked about your parents helping you with some loans, and that even got some strains on that relationship. You had a great co-founder. But in your personal life, being an entrepreneur, I know from experience, is also not easy, right? How does your relationships with friends, with a partner, how do they cope with you and your eagerness to build something?
I mean, that's a really interesting question, and very astute observation as well. So I lost a lot of friends, I guess, in when I was younger, because they just didn't understand why I was doing the things I was doing, right? To give you an example, I would go on a business trip, but I couldn't go to someone's wedding. Like that's what I would choose, right? Because if you only have so much money, like why would you this? Like why would you choose your social life over building your business? And when you're in your 20s and when your friends are not in the same like path as you, because most people go the traditional path, right? Like 9 to 5, get married, have kids, buy a house, you know, like that's what most of my friends did in Vancouver. Like, especially in a place like Vancouver, it's not San Francisco, it's not New York. So I lost a lot of friends that way, because I just didn't make the same life choices. And that was sad, right, at the time. But that's actually why I also felt more at home when I was going to New York to look for new business, but I had less friends. So at some point in my life, there was like a fork, right? There were all these friends that I went to university with and grew up with, but they were going this traditional path. And then they would see me and be like, well, when are you going to get a boyfriend? Or, you know, do you think about getting married? Do you want kids? But I didn't care about any of those things, right? I don't have kids. If I did, I wouldn't be able to do this. And that's part of the big reason I moved to New York. Is not, it wasn't really just for my business. It was just to be around people that were closer to the path that I chose and closer to my life stage. And that was probably one of the best moves for myself personally in my career that I made, because it allowed me to see people from all walks of life, right? Like in these big cities is where creative people congregate. And then you realize, actually, I can choose a different path, right? I don't have to have kids or get married. And that when I was in New York is where I met my life partner, David, who is now my co-founder at eWebinar. You know, wasn't by design, but that's what happened. And now, so David came into eWebinar a year after, because I was working with him as a contractor. And I think a lot of people think, oh, you work with your partner, like that's dangerous, right? I think it's true. Like I've seen a lot of like relationships break up because of that. And they're not even co-founder relationships, right? I've seen a lot of relationships break up because one partner doesn't understand why you have to do startups and do all the stuff and have no money and why they have to support you. And eventually that relationship disintegrates. So I do think having a supportive partner is a core of having a successful startup. But now we literally work 24/7. And it's good and bad, right? Because you don't get a break. Like you're at dinner, you're talking about your startup, right? You're in bed, you're talking about your startup. But the flip side is, if you make it work, you're now working twice as fast, right? Like back then, I would have to, like, I mean, you still have your own life. So, you know, maybe you work 10 hours a day, which is a lot already. But I would, like, if a problem happens, I would, like, have to call my co-founder off the hook and be like, hey, there's a bug, there's a customer complaining. Right now, I just turn over to David and say, hey, can you fix this? So is that good or bad? Like, it's both. right? But we're building so much faster.
But is there still like a quiet Sunday afternoon in the Vondelpark for the two of you? Or is that just completely out of the picture?
Yeah, we take our weekends very, very seriously. And we've been able to do that because eWebinar is a good business, right? Like people love the product. It's we have very low churn. It's very sticky. We're right now very, very close to profitability. So it's less important that we work so much. But we still work kind of an unhealthy amount, but we are still kind of in the beginning. I encourage my team to take time off, right? Like most our team, like don't work weekends and after hours unless there's a customer issue. Like because we have a remote team, like everybody gets to choose their own hours. The only important thing is if the customer needs you, then you have to be there. But that happens very rarely because the product is kind of set and forget and it's it kind of just runs on its own. But yeah, like we do have to set aside time to be like, okay, like this is when we're not working. And I'm terrible at that because I'm also running support. So like he absolutely hates it. Like we're watching TV, we're going for a walk, we're having dinner and I'm like answering support tickets. But, you know, we're also super early and we need all the revenue. We can't afford to lose a customer. So that's kind of where we're at. But I do think that there will be a day, and I think it's when we hit profitability where I can breathe a little, where we can choose to work a lot less and have a lot more personal time. But right now, like we've come to terms with the fact that we have to front load all this work because we want this to be successful and because we want this to help us live the life we actually want to design. And this thing that we're building is going to help us get there.
Okay. That's great to hear and great that you the both of you have a good way to work with this. What is the best advice ever given to you?
Don't marry your idea. I mean, that is an implication. It's so simple, right? But it implies so much, right? Like we are, as founders, when we're pitching our idea to investors, to friends and family, to customers, it's our baby, right? Like we believe in it so much. But sometimes you actually have to be less delusional, right? It's such a balance between having conviction in what you're doing versus being way too delusional that you're not accepting any feedback, right? And that's when you're not seeing success because you're trying so hard because you believe in yourself almost too much. And like, I think like you need some stubbornness and conviction, but not too much, right? Then you're just blinded, right? By your own ideas. So I was like that when I was much younger. And I remember walking out of my friend's office, and that was the last thing he said to me because I was trying so hard to prove him wrong. He was like, Melissa, don't marry your idea. And that was like a light bulb moment. I'm like, wow, you're right. And that changed the way I listened to feedback forever, right? Back then it was like feedback, defend myself, feedback, defend myself. But now it's like, oh, interesting. Like, why are you saying that? I mean, I still have my own, you know, I still have my own stubbornness and my own conviction, but I'm much more open to seeing other people's perspective.
Yeah, there's a famous story. I think it's called Don't Fall in Love with Your Monkey, about the researcher and monkeys in the laboratory, right? So that's the moral of that story, what you just shared. That's great advice. What's something that's not a secret, but most people don't know about you?
Something that's not a secret that most people don't know. I was a digital nomad for 3 years after I left New York. We now have a home base in Amsterdam, but we still mostly live on the road.
It has been a challenge in the couple of last years with all the COVID regulations and restrictions and that kind of thing. So where was the last trip and where is the next trip going then?
Actually, it was challenging, but just different. So during COVID, before COVID, we used to be in a place for like 2 weeks, a week, 3 weeks. Like we were constantly bouncing around. But during COVID, we were in a place for 4 months. Like we were actually stuck in Hong Kong for 7 months. And it was just a different way of traveling. It was nice because everybody else was in the city. And then you just got to know the city in a different way. And you got to know people in a different way. So that was an interesting experience. The last place was Bali. Actually, I just got back about a week ago. And it's my first time in Bali, surprisingly. And the next place is going to be Thailand in December.
Okay. Yeah, it's great cities and great places, not too far away from here. That's correct. If there's one thing you want people to take away from this talk, what would it be?
That's also a big question. If there's one thing I want people to take away, is you should always do something that makes you happy. Versus something that you have experience in. And what I mean by that is and I fell into the same trap. Like people think this is my education. Like I studied to be, an investment banker. So I'm going to get a job at a bank. Or I studied to be a lawyer. So I'm going to be a lawyer. But if that's not what you truly love, then your life is going to be very difficult. Like I started a company in real estate because I had experience in real estate and that's where my contacts were. I thought that's what I had to do. Not once did I ask myself, what are the things that make me happy? And then find a business on top of that. I got a chance to do that. And I learned that over the years and I got a chance to do that before starting eWebinar, right? I asked myself, what are the non-negotiables I have to have in life, right? What are the things that actually make me happy? And then I chose an idea and a business that fit my non-negotiables instead of being like, oh, I had experience in this, so I have to do this. So I don't think enough founders ask themselves, what are the things in life that would feed my happiness? And how do I design a business on top of that? Because it's going to be so hard anyway. So if you're not doing something that feeds into your happiness at the end of the day, you can still do it, but that's what makes it exhausting.
That's a great key takeaway. Melissa, I want to thank you for your valuable insights and sharing and your lessons learned in startups. For the listeners, although the rating system of podcasts is hideous, if you like this Mea Culpa series, you can rate this podcast with 5 stars at the Motivation for the Makers. I want to thank Copy Ventures in Hong Kong for being the venue sponsor for this episode and making this series possible. If you have any suggestions for guests, please let us know. Find us contact details in the show notes. So thank you very much. Melissa, thank you.
Thanks so much.
This is Jeffrey Brewer. Go out and build something meaningful.